That's John Coltrane opening up on Blue Train, the title track of his 1957 album. Lee Morgan on trumpet, Curtis Fuller on trombone, Kenny Drew on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and Philly Joe Jones on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, January the 20th, 2015. And the U.S. Supreme Court hears oral arguments tomorrow in the closely watched Inclusive Communities Project versus Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs, a case challenging government-subsidized and or government-condoned housing segregation. The court will decide whether the federal government and states can continue to implement policies that, according to a group of scholars, perpetuate or exacerbate racial segregation in housing, even without intent. Richard Rothstein, a research associate with the Washington, D.C.-based Economic Policy Institute and senior fellow of the Chief Justice Earl Warren Institute on Law and Social Policy at the University of California at Berkeley School of Law, is our guest today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Morning.
Thank you. Well, the last time we talked, it was about Ferguson, Missouri, and you gave us a comprehensive overview of the history of that town as a sundown town. Thank you so much for being with us again today. Now, a large group of housing scholars, historians, and activists not only is closely watching this case, but has filed a friend of the court brief. What, from your point of view, is the stake in this case?
The Fair Housing Act that was passed in 1968 requires all government agencies that are involved in the housing area to affirmatively further fair housing. That is, to take affirmative steps to ensure that we are creating an integrated society, not perpetuating a segregated one. In this case, program called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program. It's a federal program that gives tax credits to states to distribute to developers who propose to build low and moderate income housing. And these tax credits have been used by developers around the country to place low and moderate income housing disproportionately in low-income and minority neighborhoods, perpetuating and in some cases exacerbating racial segregation. The state of Texas claims that they should be permitted to do this because their intent is not to create segregation or to exacerbate segregation. It just happens to be a byproduct of a benign policy to place housing in a place that's convenient for tenants who may want to move from their apartments that may be deteriorating in a low-income and deteriorating neighborhood to these new developments. And the Supreme Court is going to take up the question of whether it is lawful to pursue a policy that creates segregation so long as your intent is not to do so, or to perpetuate segregation so long as your intent is not to do so. The legal term for this is disparate impact. In other words, the Supreme Court is going to make a decision about whether policies should be unlawful if they have a disparate impact on minorities by perpetuating segregation. The Department of Housing and Urban Development and civil rights advocates believe strongly that disparate impact must be a standard that is used to evaluate these projects, because once you have a segregated metropolitan area that was segregated by a century of public practices, you don't have to intentionally want to perpetuate or exacerbate that segregation to have the effect of doing so, because you're placing projects like the low-income housing tax credit projects in a metropolitan area that's already segregated. So unless you affirmatively take action to undo that segregation, you're going to perpetuate and exacerbate it. And we say, in violation of the Fair Housing Act's requirement, that you affirmatively further fair housing.
Well, I'm drawing again on your previous appearance with us when you said in relation to Ferguson that Ferguson was symptomatic of public policy that essentially was a conspiracy among governmental agencies to engineer racial segregation by engineering housing.
That's correct. What I talked about when we spoke earlier, based on a report I did on called The Making of Ferguson, was how public policies of the federal, state, and local governments, not only in St. Louis, but nationwide, purposely created segregated neighborhoods. For example, the Federal Housing Administration financed mass production builders to create suburbs only on condition that those builders refused to sell homes to African Americans, resulting in St. Louis, and with the same policy nationwide, in a situation where the entire metropolitan area is segregated, where whites are living in middle-class suburbs from which African Americans are excluded by federal policy, and blacks are increasingly living in urban areas, inner cities, with public housing projects that were specifically designated for them. Now, what happened in recent years is that as the concentration of African Americans in overcrowded inner city neighborhoods and in public housing that was concentrating low-income African Americans, the neighborhoods where African Americans were concentrated and overcrowded became slums because they had no place, the families had no place where they could acquire acceptable housing, and so the neighborhoods became more and more overcrowded. That men couldn't find access to jobs. They were far from jobs. They had moved to the suburbs. Unemployment grew. We had more single parent families because there were no men or few men who were able to support families. And so you had slums created by these very explicit racial public policies of the federal and state and local governments. And then the federal, state, and local governments looked at these slums and said, well, we're now going to do slum clearance. And so they demolished the public housing, they demolished the low-income neighborhoods, and the residents were forced into adjoining inner-ring suburbs like Ferguson. That's how Ferguson became predominantly black. Well, the low-income housing tax credit program just exacerbates that situation because it disproportionately places low-income housing projects in neighborhoods like Ferguson. Opponents, as I say, claim that they don't intend to increase the segregation at Ferguson. It's just a convenient place to place these projects. And the argument that we're making is that this should be prohibited by the Fair Housing Act, and developers who are using this federal tax credit to build low and moderate income housing should be required to place them in high opportunity neighborhoods, that is, in middle class neighborhoods, so that we have an integrated society where neighborhoods have both middle-class and moderate-income housing. Children can go to school together. We have integrated schools as a result. And if we cannot require the placement of these projects in high-opportunity neighborhoods, There is very little hope of closing the achievement gap in schools from African-American children who go to segregated, hyper-segregated schools where there are very few resources relative to middle-class neighborhoods. And so it's a very important case, not only for the housing issue, but also in terms of the future of public education and the aim that we all have to narrow the achievement gap between low-income African-American students and middle-class students.
What do you say to the argument that this is more a matter of class than race, that in fact, even in white communities, you see that there's a sense of people wanting to live in neighborhoods with people similarly situated in terms of their earning power, their income, and their lifestyle, that even in white communities, you see this this line of demarcation where communities tend to be kind of, you know, the same. And therefore, this is more a matter of class than race.
Well, there are two responses I have to that. First, if you look at demographic data, you will see that low-income whites are dispersed throughout the white population. There are very, very few, once you leave Appalachia, very few neighborhoods in metropolitan areas with high concentrations of low-income white families. White families tend to be living in neighborhoods where they're integrated with middle-class families. That's not the case with African-Americans, who are concentrated in ghettos that were created by public policy. The second response to that question that you've asked is the following. Public policy created the segregation that I've described, and we have a constitutional obligation to reverse it. That is, white families may prefer to live in neighborhoods that are all white and they're segregated and where there are no families of low income, but they don't have a constitutional right to do so. We have a constitution which prohibited the creation of these segregated neighborhoods. The 13th and 14th Amendments prohibited it. They were created in violation of the Constitution, and their perpetuation is in violation of the Fair Housing Act. So the fact that some white families may prefer to live in homogenous, isolated white enclaves does not provide a justification for the federal and state governments assisting them in doing so.
I want to come to the question of intent. A central piece of the argument here is that the policy should be discontinued even when it is shown that there was no intent here by the government to continue these racial policies, these segregation policies. How does one prove intent?
One shouldn't have to prove intent. It is very few people today are so unsophisticated that they enact a policy and say that my purpose in enacting this policy is to reinforce segregation. If that's the standard, then we will never be able to desegregate America. We will never solve the kinds of problems that we've been seeing in black communities around the country, because public officials are not going to go around saying that we are placing low-income housing in low-income neighborhoods because we want to segregate low-income families and minority families in ghettos. So that requiring an intent is giving up on the goal of the Fair Housing Act to create integrated neighborhoods, and it's giving up on enforcing the 13th and 14th Amendments. The segregation of our metropolitan areas was created intentionally. 20th century, public officials had no qualms about saying that their purpose was to isolate the African-American community in ghettos. As I said earlier, the Fair Housing Act, the Federal Housing Administration subsidized the builders around the country to create suburbs that were explicitly segregated. You could not get a bank guarantee if you were a developer. Like Levittown or in New York or Daly City in California, you could not get a government guarantee to construct those developments unless you pledged not to sell homes to African Americans. That was an explicit federal intent. Well, once the intent sets up the segregated situation, you don't need to have intent to perpetuate it. But you do need to have a reverse intent to desegregate it, to undo the unconstitutional actions of the federal, state, and local governments in creating these ghettos. And that needs to be an affirmative policy that is pursued by the federal, state, and local governments.
Can we talk about what the challenges are as you see them as the case comes before the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, the challenge is that we have a Supreme Court with a four-member plurality and perhaps a five-member majority, which is inclined to say that unless you're a raving racist, anything you do should be permitted. That unless you can prove intent, you cannot be prohibited from exacerbating segregation. This is, of course, the way they've approached educational issues. They have refused to permit school districts to pursue integration policies unless you can prove that the school district had intentionally segregated students, and they're trying to reverse this intentional segregation. It's a theme of the current Supreme Court. We're hopeful, I don't think necessarily optimistic, but we're hopeful that this theme of insisting that you be an out-and-out racist in order to be prevented from exacerbating segregation, we're hopeful and hoping that the Supreme Court will not continue that line of reasoning in this particular case. I think that's the challenge that we're up against.
One of your areas of specialty is education, and you've written quite a bit about it. You've done a great deal of research about it. And in this conversation, you have linked this case to education. Could you talk about the relationship between housing segregation and education?
Yes, of course. The reason that most of our segregated in metropolitan areas in this country is that they're located in segregated neighborhoods, and schools for black children living in inner city communities, the distances are too far to create meaningful integration policies so long as the neighborhoods remain segregated. When children attend schools segregated in low-income, minority, or almost all minority neighborhoods, it is very, very difficult. It's impossible for schools to accomplish what they need to accomplish with those children. When children come to school, if a couple of children are in a school and they come to school in a middle-class school and they come to school from families where the parents are poorly educated, where they haven't been read to a lot at home, where they're not in as good health as their peers, teachers can devote special attention to those children and can bring them much closer up to the grade level standard of the school as a whole. When you have classrooms where every single child needs special attention, you obviously can't give special attention to every single child. Instruction tends to be remedial in those classrooms, not on grade level. There are many more disciplinary problems in the school because children are coming to school unprepared to learn. So it's very, very difficult, and I'd say almost impossible, to substantially raise the achievement of very disadvantaged minority children in highly segregated schools. The only way to raise their achievement, and there are certainly enough experiments that we've seen now to show that it works, the only way to raise their achievement is to integrate them into middle-class schools. And when they're integrated into middle-class schools, their achievement improves without any harm being done to the middle-class students with whom they're attending school. They can then get the special attention they need. They have an environment of higher educational standards, and they achieve more. The research is quite solid that children who have gone to integrated schools have higher earnings as adults. They are more likely to graduate from high school. They're more likely to go to college. They're less likely to be single parents when they grow up. They're less likely to be involved in criminal activity. All of these results are now well documented by research. For low-income children who attend integrated schools compared to low-income children who attend segregated schools. So the research is solid on this. If The low-income housing tax credit program, to take the example of this particular case, is permitted to continue to place ponderance of housing units in segregated neighborhoods. It will quash hopes of creating integrated neighborhoods and integrated schools that we need to narrow this achievement gap. The way to narrow the achievement gap is to take these projects, the low-income housing tax credit projects of low and moderate-income housing, and disperse them throughout the metropolitan area so that children whose families live in those projects can attend integrated schools.
Well, I want to talk about a different strain of thought here, and that is there are people who say, well, in as much as we are segregated, we'll work with that. However, the issue for us is not integration per se, but the allocation, the proper allocation of resources so that we can achieve exactly what other communities achieve with the resources that we should have access to, so that it is okay if society wants segregation, and in fact, it might be a plus because it reinforces cultural identity, it reinforces our sense of self, it reinforces our notion of independence and so forth, and it there's a certain amount of comfort one derives from being on one among one's own, because there are many segregated communities in the United States. I think of the Orthodox Jewish community. I think of the Amish community. There are many communities that are segregated, but appear to be doing well or prefer to be operating in a segregated state. So what is the insistence, or what is the argument that the integration necessarily isn't in and of itself a benefit?
60 years after Brown versus Board of Education, it's incredible that you're repeating, I mean, not you personally, but that you're expressing this defense of separate but equal society. This is a violation of our Constitution. African Americans are not segregating themselves, have not segregated themselves the way Orthodox Jewish communities have or Amish communities have. They were segregated involuntarily by federal, state, and local policy. If we reverse that segregation and integrate African Americans in the broader population, once that's done, if some want to create enclaves like Amish or Orthodox Jews, they're free to do so. But the idea that we should abandon our fundamental constitutional goal, our fundamental national identity of being an integrated society is taking us back to the separate but equal era of Plessy v. Ferguson. It's taking us back to the Jim Crow era. And in fact, it has never worked. We have tried now for, well, most of a century. Policy has advocated, oh, we'll improve the ghetto. 50 years ago, there was a debate about this, and leading scholars, Daniel Patrick Moynihan was one of the mm-hmm. far-sighted scholars on this. He called it gilding the ghetto, attempts to gild the ghetto. He said it won't work, it can't work, and we've had now 50 years of experience where it hasn't worked. We've had model cities, we've had block grants given to cities, we've had enterprise zones, we've had one attempt after another to create separate but equal metropolitan areas. We haven't come close to making that kind of thing work, and it can't work for the reasons I described before. When you take the example of education, we take children who come to school and in disadvantaged circumstances, from poor health, without the experience of coming from a highly literate home, without any college-educated role models in their neighborhood, coming to school in high degrees of stress because of living in a violent neighborhood, and you concentrate those in a single school and in a single classroom, you cannot get the kind of results that you can get from those same children if you place them in integrated settings. That was the underlying theory of Brown versus Board of Education. It's the underlying theory of our Constitution. and of our national ideals. And it would be a worse than tragic if we abandoned our national ideals and reverted to a separate but equal aim that existed before Brown 60 years ago now.
Is there a project that is typical of the kind of change that you'd like to see currently in existence?
As I said, we've had research showing that when you have integrated schools, the disadvantaged minority children not only have better short-term achievement, but they have long-term outcomes as adults that are far superior to identical children who attend segregated schools. There was a study done just a few years ago of Montgomery County, Maryland, where they scattered their public housing units throughout the county area. Montgomery County is a mostly middle-class area, and the results were dramatic. What the study showed was that the children the public housing eligible children who were placed in higher income neighborhoods did better than the public housing eligible children who were identical in every respect because they were randomly assigned to high income neighborhoods and more middle class neighborhoods. The higher the income the neighborhood, the better the children did. So we have lots of evidence that integration works, and we have even more evidence that segregation doesn't work.
So the case comes to the U.S. Supreme Court tomorrow. Oral arguments begin. What is the timeline for a decision?
Well, nobody can predict that. It could be in June. You can't predict when the Supreme Court issues a decision, but they will hear oral arguments tomorrow. And they will take their time in making a decision. It could be soon. It could be at the end of the current court term. It could be put over to next year. Nobody can predict what the court will do in that respect.
If the court does vote that the situation should remain as is, that there's no need to on the basis of intent particularly, there's no need to change current policies, what is the fallback position of those like you and the Economic Policy Institute who have filed friend of the court briefs in the case?
Let me be clear about one thing, correct you about one thing. The current situation is that the Department of Housing and Urban Development interprets the Fair Housing Act as prohibiting activities that exacerbate segregation, even if there's no provable intent to do so. So the current situation is the one that we should continue. What the court is being asked to do is prohibit the Department of Housing and Urban Development or prohibit civil rights groups from challenging actions like those in this case that exacerbate segregation. If the court prohibits the use of the disparate impact standard, which is what this is called, prohibiting evaluating activities on the basis of whether they have a disparate impact on minorities by enhancing segregation, then it's going to be very, very difficult, very, very difficult to, without legislation, additional legislation, which is not likely to happen in the current Congress, it's going to be very, very difficult to pursue integration, and is going to further lock in segregation of metropolitan areas and doom low-income African-American children to lower achievement, lower life chances, and less quality adult lives.
Well, I want to thank you so much for this briefing. It is a very significant case indeed, and we will follow it up as it warrants. Thank you so much, Richard Rothstein, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks. We'll take this break, and when we come back, we'll deal with the question, when is a lynching not a lynching? This relates to chokeholds. We'll be right back. You're listening to PRN.FM, and you're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Yatrice Lead. Last Tuesday, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio vowed to veto any legislation the City Council passes to make chokeholds illegal. Current NYPD policy banning chokeholds is sufficient, de Blasio said, and besides, training given police officers will further reduce its use by police officers. Councilman Rory Lankman, who sponsored a chokehold bill, says he has enough votes to override de Blasio's veto. The councilman's legislation, however, will make it only a misdemeanor to use a chokehold. Our guest, attorney at law, Alton H. Maddox Jr., who I call the people's attorney general, contends that all sides in the legislative face down, de Blasio, the city council, and the police unions, are skirting the real issue about chokeholds. By legal definition, he argues, chokeholds are a form of lynching and should be dealt as such by the law. Thank you, Alton, for being with us today.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Yatrice.
All right, so let's get straight to it. What is your contention that a chokehold, by legal definition, should be regarded as lynching?
Well, I want to first cite my qualifications in this area. I have a number of years of experience. Cases like Michael Stewart and Tawana Brawley and another case that I had, Booker Briggs, all turn on forensics. I mean, there's a lot of other cases turn on, too. But those significantly turned on forensics, and I had received additional training in forensics at Northwestern University in Chicago in the 1970s, and I furthered that at the National Institute of Trial Advocacy at the University of Colorado, recognizing, you know, that when you're going to have to really deal with these serious cases, you have to have some real serious training and background. And so out of that background, certainly I was able to understand that the key word in any lynching is strangulation. That's the key word. It's the common word in any lynching is strangulation. And that there are two major types of strangulation. One is a manual strangulation, which is actually what we call a chokehold. And the other one is a ligature strangulation, which most of us can identify with because it relates to ropes or something of that type. And so when you look at chokeholds, you have to understand that prior to de Blasio and prior to even Anthony Baez, who was the victim of a chokehold, there was a policy in this city that kind of lynching would not take place. Of course, what is important is that lynching is not a federal crime. And so you can lynch a black person, and you can't really say, well, lynching is the reason why you should go to jail because you lynched somebody, because it's not a federal crime. Lynching is also not a state crime. And so basically that explains why somebody like the district attorney in Staten Island would charge the jury that no crime occurred, because it's not a part of state law to lynch a black person. And so with these issues confronting the black community and the additional issue of anyone who films a chokehold and makes it available to the news media should also be prosecuted, we're in a situation now where I haven't heard any leading black black selected official addressed this issue. And so I'm going back into Staten Island on Thursday at 9 a.m., and I'm asking everybody to join me out in Staten Island, because I don't know of anything more important to our survival at this point in the question of lynching. And if you can't be outraged by lynching a black person, I don't think you can get outraged about anything. And the point that I'm making in Staten Island first is that I was disciplined unlawfully for 5 years. After those 5 years, the indefinite suspension has continued for 25 years. So, you know, you have a definite suspension of 5 years, and you're supposed to be reinstated to the practice of law. But I've been out here for 25 years. Now, to put that in proper perspective, if someone had been sentenced to prison for 5 years, and 25 years later, that person was still in prison. And then after that, the person decided, well, I better just fly over the cuckoo's nest and get out of here. That person, when captured, it would be unlawful or wrong to prosecute that person for escape. And so that's my position in Staten Island. If somebody has been denied the right to practice law for 25 years on a five-year sentence, it is absolutely wrong for New York to take any action against me after 25 years, especially since judges filed false instruments that created the 5 years in the first place, and the prosecutor's office, the New York State Attorney General, filed false declarations in federal court. And so, you know, that is my reason for saying that somebody has to stand up. And, you know, I would love for all black public officials, all Latino public officials, any kind of to be in Staten Island with me. But whether anybody's in Staten Island with me or not, I will be there. And I will have a clear conscience that I'm walking in the footsteps of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who said an injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And so
be going into greater detail, because we will be talking about this tomorrow, this specific issue tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to talk about the contention, because we want to focus on this chokehold question. And you raised the question that chokeholds should be understood to be lynchings.
Well,
According to Section 20311 of the Patrol Guide, which governs the use of force, chokeholds are explicitly forbidden and prohibited. It says, the directive from the police department says, members of the New York City Police Department will not, and not was capitalized and underscored, use chokeholds. A chokehold shall include, but is not limited to, any pressure to the throat or windpipe which may prevent or hinder breathing or reduce intake or air. So, to your mind, how does this qualify as a lynching?
Well, it qualifies as a lynching because all lynchings are strangulations. I mean, you know, you have to cut off the air. I mean, that's why Eric Garner is not with us today, because the medical examiner found out that he couldn't get the necessary amount of oxygen that would allow him to survive the vicious attack by these rogue cops.
And the city council wanted to, at least the legislation being offered now, is to make it a misdemeanor, just the same.
And that's why everybody should be absolutely outraged, because when de Blasio first ran for office, he said, I'm going to cut things like that out, period. And he wasn't really cutting that out, much out, because that was already the law. And the only thing he wants to do now is to cut out the fact that it is illegal. And that should be disturbing to everybody, who cast a vote for de Blasio, and every last one of those persons should find themselves in Staten Island on Thursday. I mean, you can't have it both ways. You can't create a problem by putting somebody else in office who then tries to try and betray you, and you don't feel no responsibility or guilt for the death of Eric Garner and the various other persons who have died since Eric Garner as a result of chokeholds.
You said that the chokehold is not a federal crime. It is not a state crime. So when these chokeholds are applied and they do result in death, typically what are the charges since they are not federal or state crimes? Typically what kinds of charges result?
Well, the answer would be what kind of investigation results. And the answer to that is none. And that's the reason why there's no investigation in Eric Garner, and there's no investigation in other similarly situated killings, because nothing happens. And that's the problem. There's nothing on the books, period. You know, and so, you know, you're going to have Andrew Cuomo standing up there talking tomorrow about zero. He's not talking about putting any legislation on the books that prevent lynchings in New York. And that is a serious problem, and that's the reason why every black person within the sound of my voice and beyond should be in Staten Island to register our dissent on Thursday.
The Civilian Complaint Review Board had released a 139-page report last year on more than 1,000 chokehold claims that were filed against police in the past 5.5 years. And the board found, among other things, that NYPD officials, and they use this word, emasculated the definition of chokehold. And so there is this confusion, or apparent confusion, between police and the complaint review board and even the city council, elected officials, about what exactly is a chokehold. And we see that now playing out in the fact that nobody has been held responsible, including this the officer, Daniel Pantaleo, who applied the chokehold to Eric Garner. We're seeing that there is a lack of indictment because it has been deemed that, again, maybe he applied something called a lateral hold or some other thing that they're making up, but not a chokehold. So we still have this problem about what a chokehold is.
Well, yeah, we do have this problem what a chokehold is, but we won't have this problem after Thursday. We may have it before Thursday. We won't have it after Thursday. You know, just like some people had a problem with a second grand jury indicting cops. But we didn't have that problem after I got involved in that case. And the law is that you can indict cops, and that's what where this rogue cop and others would be headed to after Thursday. We had a question about what special prosecutors. We didn't have that after I made the appearance in Howard Beach. That got resolved. So that's my point. If people want to really make sure that this issue is going to be answered and that somebody is going to stand up who does not have any lack of starch in their back, you know, those persons are going to be out in Staten Island on Thursday because these discussions and others will take place at that particular time. Now, if New York, on the other hand, decide they want to arrest me, then that's fine. Because then we'll know that the people that have been hanging out with Al Sharpton and people like George Wallace and Bull Connors. So, you know, I mean, it doesn't make me know what happens on Thursday because people are going to be enlightened one way or the other because the question is, how could you have the mayor of the city of New York come to your Dr. King celebration after he has stated unequivocally that he's for lynchings of blacks? Dr. King has to be turning over in his grave, and I think the fact that you won't find Sharpton in Staten Island, anywhere near Staten Island on Thursday, should give even the most clueless Negro some glimpse of who Al Sharpton is.
I want to come back again about this issue of chokeholds. What, in your view, should be the course here to redefine, specifically redefine chokeholds, or to get some kind of definition as to what it is? I mean, the whole word itself should be a clue. Chokehold. You choking somebody while you hold them. Why this is to be at the maximum, according to the city council, a mere misdemeanor, when in fact it has resulted in so many deaths. And the most recent one, as we continue to say, is the chokehold applied to Eric Garner, but there have been several others. We talked on this program about the Inspector General for the New York Police Department recently issuing a report in which he basically said that none of the chokeholds, including those that proved to be fatal, ever resulted in the prosecution of a police officer.
Yeah, and what we will be doing, Eutrice, obviously, the first line of testimony obviously should come persons who are experts in medicine. And that testimony will be pretty much clear, and any drafting of legislation will be based on that testimony. You know, let me say right now that I've already written 20 areas of concern that should be a part of a 2015 legislative agenda on the police. And that agenda is going to be finalized and perfected and submitted to the New York legislature. We're not going to wait on black elected officials to do that, because they can't pass any laws, period. So this is a people's effort in order to throw this legislation out there and demonstrate what New York City and New York State is about. Because if the Democratic Party thinks that they're going to come in and hold a convention in New York, a state that practices lynchings, they got to be out of their minds. That will not happen. And Schumer and Cuomo and de Blasio and everybody else should take note. We are not going to allow a state that promotes lynchings of blacks, unarmed blacks, to add insult to injury, to allow it to profit off our pain and suffering.
Why has the, I mean, in the aftermath, the immediate aftermath of the issuing of this report by the Inspector General, we had the Civilian Complaint Review Board pretty much saying the same thing after it reviewed all of these more than 1,000 chokeholds in the past 5.5 years. We have had no movement really to discuss this matter of chokeholds used by police. And it still is the case, because Daniel Pantaleo recently was called in for a departmental hearing. So this raises the question, even when chokeholds are applied, it doesn't seem that any legal apparatus investigates that and takes it seriously, because now we have the department itself with the police commissioner in effect acting or taking on the responsibilities of a judicial system in deciding whether a chokehold actually was a lethal instrument or not.
Well, you know, this goes to another area of the law, Eutrice, that has to be buttressed. And I think that what our people got to understand is that people who have not been trained in the law and have not used the law to promote the welfare of a people should not be listened to. Now, the point that you are making is well taken, because one of the problems that we have in the law in New York is Article 140 of the criminal procedure law, and that particular article relates to arrest, and that particular article has to be up to comply with the Fourth Amendment. And the Fourth Amendment required is that any time that you have probable cause for an arrest should take place. There's no such thing as a prosecutor deciding what arrest should take place. Once probable cause is clear, arrest should take place. Once probable cause has been established, no prosecutor should be able to turn back on a runaway grand jury in their mind and say, well, we're not going to prosecute DSK for the rape of Miss Diallo, because that should be strengthened in the law. No prosecutor should be able to say that when we have a female official from the National Action Network and we have in Rubenstein's apartment 10 used condoms and a bottle of Viagra of Al Sharpton, no prosecutor should be able to say that we are not going to prosecute. And that's where the loopholes are. There is discretion, but you can't exercise that discretion when there's clear case of probable cause. And that's where the breakdown is coming up. And that's why, you know, people who can clearly know how to write legislation, and apparently these black selected officials can't, will be called upon to clear the deck and clean house in New York.
Well, for one thing, it is to be noted that I would expect that a situation like this with the none other than the mayor saying that he will veto any legislation applying to chokeholds, and then the other legislator saying, well, we for legislation, but it will be a misdemeanor, you know. One would imagine that the attorneys representing a man who was, in fact, dispatched from this earth via chokehold would be at front and center of this discussion. One would imagine that Al Sharpton would have been at front and center of this discussion.
Well, you see, they were AWOL in the Central Park 7, and now they're AWOL now. And the problem is the ambulance chasers are not expected to seek justice. Their mission is to seek hush money. We must make a distinction between those who are ambulance chasers and those who are real social engineers and social architects. And that does not include ambulance chasers.
So what do you intend to do in terms of the redefinition of this chokehold term? What is going to happen, do you think?
Well, the first thing going to happen is the person who actually brought this to the attention of the United States and the world, Ramsey Orr, is going to be free of any indictment. I mean, that's my really first step. And then after that step, you know, then we will proceed with these other matters. But my intention is to serve notice that anybody who films a lynching will not be subject to a criminal prosecution for filming a lynching. And that has to first clear the deck, because there's some real fear of people now, as a result of Ramsey Orr, keeping their cameras and cell phones in their pockets.
Well, I want to thank you, Alton. You'll be with us tomorrow. We'll be discussing the Ramsey Orr case in particular tomorrow. But this matter of the lynching and the definition and the legal definition of lynching and all of the legal fireworks that are going on around it without the appropriate result. This is the focus of our discussion today. So I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tree. Let me just say one quick thing. 311, use it early and often to find selected officials and contact them. 311. It is very important that we lay the foundation for what we get ready to do on Thursday, and that is the foundation, 311.
Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. We learned quite a lot about this housing case, and we see how things are all connected, and we see also how deliberate the policies have been and continue to be to engineer inequality. And then comes this, you know, we get these reports about, oh my goodness, there's inequality in America. Well, of course there is, because it's been engineered. And it has had long-lasting impact and deliberately targeted at people who are believed to be perfect for oppression. So I want to thank you so much for joining me today. Keep it right here on PRN.FM as we grow and continue to be relevant to people looking for solid information. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. I want to thank you so much for the pleasure and privilege of your company. Tonight, of course, the President makes his State of the Union address. As you can tell, I'm not entirely enthused about it. I believe the President has pretty much indicated the degree to which he is relevant to the lives of the vast majority of people who are suffering in this country and who voted for him. But you might be inclined to listen. At some point, I'll find out whether there was anything particularly noteworthy about his State of the Union address to discuss. Thanks. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye. Thank you.